Kathy and Mike, and they're from the Harry This Message Group of West Orange. And Kathy's there, so.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kathy Lawrence, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic. My home group is, as I said, the Carry This Message Group in West Orange, New Jersey. And my sobriety date is January 1st, 1991. I did not make a New Year's resolution. It was sort of like an after a night of a lot of drinking and hitting bottom and finally saying, you know, enough is enough. I don't want this anymore. That I didn't come into the room. I said enough is enough, and I wanted to die because that was the only solution at that point that I knew existed. Alcohol wasn't working for me, but I didn't have the solution that I have found in these rooms. So I tried to kill myself. I tried to die. And on December 31st, 1990, I took as many pills as I could find in the house. And I had quite a few of them because I was stockpiling them for quite a while, thinking that this day might come. And I didn't, luckily it wasn't my time. And I guess I was found before I was too far gone. And I never saw 1991 come in. So as far as I'm concerned, it's still 1990, of course. No, I never saw 1991 come in. I didn't see January 1st or somewhere around January 2nd, I think I came to in the hospital. And the very first thought in my head when I came to was, you stupid jerk, you can't even kill yourself, can you? And that's really how I felt. I felt like there was nothing left of me. There was nothing left inside of me. Going back a bit, I was thinking about, I heard somebody speak, I was listening to a tape and I heard somebody say this one time, and it was funny. She said, I didn't come from an alcoholic family. Wait a minute, of course I did. I was in that family, and I was the alcoholic, so I must have come from an alcoholic family. My immediate family were not particular drinkers, but I was. I thought about it when I heard it, and I'm going, that's so like who I am. I want to separate myself. I want to be different then. I have to separate myself from wherever I am. And it's this dichotomy of I want to separate myself and I want to be part of. Please accept me, but I'm different. And that's kind of what I did my whole life. My first drink of alcohol came when I was pretty young, probably about 6 months old. My mom said she used alcohol to rub my gums when I was a little kid teething. And she said, you smiled a lot. I said, oh, okay. So I must have really enjoyed it. And I remember growing up as a kid, alcohol was a medicine. You know, you got sick, you got a little bit of whiskey and a glass of some warm water and a little whiskey glass. And it was supposed to make you feel better and break the fever. And so what I remember, what I equate alcohol with is comfort, my parents' attention, and feeling warm and safe. So even though there's not alcoholism particularly in my family, and I didn't drink when I was growing up. I'm a late bloomer. I didn't start drinking until I got away to college. I was the goody two-shoes during school. But alcohol equated with that warm fuzzy, that nice comfortable feeling inside, and I'm taken care of, and it's good. And I think that's what I searched for my whole life, that trying to fill that emptiness inside. Trying to fill the hole that I didn't even know existed, but I was trying to fill it with everything I could find on the outside. My drunkalogue is not all that exciting. I had some fun times. I had a lot of fun times, actually. I had some really rough times. I did a lot of social drinking initially. I actually was social. Of course, I got drunk, but it was at least I was out. I was at the bars. I was doing all sorts of things. But at some point, it turned inside, and it became my whole life. And I did nothing but go to work and drink. And I did that for about 3 years, and I cut off people in my life. I didn't. At that point, people were starting to interfere with the only thing that I thought worked. So I cut people off. I didn't want to have anybody in my life. because at that point alcohol was the only thing in my life that made me even begin to feel better. And so when you tried to take that away from me, I didn't want to have you in my life, so out you go. And I tend to be an isolator anyhow. There is, I think, inside of me, I always called it the little kernel of health, but I think it's that seed of the grace of God that was in me that also pulls me out every once in a while when I get too far into that abyss. And I don't know how long the grace of God will continue to do that for me, so I need to take some actions. But this time, and it was one of the first times that I felt it, that it pulled me out of this abyss and said, you know what, you really can't spend that much time alone. You know, you're dying for people. You're dying for somebody to come and be with you. You're lonely. Stop isolating. You know, take some action. So I did, you know, and I went out and I started to take class. And I met a woman. Lo and behold, gee, we tend to find each other. She was working where I was taking this class because she had lost her license to drug addiction. So we tend to find each other. It's amazing. The magnet's like, boom, you know. There's a lonely person. We find each other. And it tends to feed it, you know, feed that. Sometimes it feeds the addiction and feeds the alcoholism, the disease. We got to be friends. And we really did feed. She learned how to be an alcoholic very quickly. We really did feed each other's diseases. I hated her disease in her, but I couldn't see it in me. She hated my disease in me, and she couldn't see it in herself. Long story short, she had been a drug addict. She was a pharmacist who was a drug addict, who became an alcoholic, who convinced Board of Pharmacy that she was rehabilitated. They gave her license back. Within about 2 or 3 weeks of getting her a job in the pharmacy, she was bringing stuff home, and within a year she was dead. I'm still drinking through all of this, and I still can't see that it doesn't work for me. My bottom came, I said, on January 1st, 1991, when I had enough. And Jane had died 3 years before I came into the program. So I still spent another 3 years of trying to figure out how I can do this by myself. And I couldn't. So I came in, I tried to commit suicide, I couldn't. When I came out of ICU, they sent me over to the psych ward. I was under there under dual diagnosis. I was both a suicide attempt and an alcoholic. And at that point, I didn't care. I said, there was nothing left of me. There really wasn't. I wasn't trying to fill the hole. I felt like I was the hole. All of me was the whole. And so it didn't matter where I went anymore. If you told me to go over there, I went over there. I didn't fight anybody. I wasn't an argumentative, nasty drunk. I just, you know, fine, I'll go over there. I had no will of my own, which is probably one of the best places I could ever be at that point in time. I don't want to go back there ever. But for me, it was probably one of the best places I could be because I was willing. I finally had an open mind. It wasn't crowded with all of the stuff that I thought I could do. And I didn't know it at the time, by the way. I just, again, grace of God comes in. I'm sitting, they brought meetings into the hospital, into the detox, and I'm sitting in the room. And they had three or four, and I've been to a couple meetings now that, you know, had been in, and I don't remember a thing they said. This one night, a group came in, and the gentleman was talking, and he didn't have any special message. He didn't speak any more eloquently than anybody else did. But one of the things he did was he challenged me. And he looked at each one of us, and he looked us in the eye. And what he said was, the statistics say that probably none of you are going to make it. And I am a very obnoxious, you know, you tell me I can't, and I'm going to. And that's really what happened for me. I said, like, well, I'll show you. I'm going to get sober. I don't care, just to prove you're wrong. And I did. That's how I looked at it then. What I look at it today was another place where the grace of God came in my life and said, all right, you know, open your ears, open your eyes, and open your heart. And there is another way to live. I came into the rooms crying, shaking, having no idea what I was doing. There was a gentleman standing at the door. If I get teary over this, I still do. But Tony was at the door, and it was my first home group. Tony was at that door, and he was at that door up till about a year and a half ago when he died of cancer, sober. But he was always at that door on a Tuesday night in South Orange. He was always there, and his hand was always out. And I walked in, and he recognized that I was a newcomer. And so he, I don't know how he knew it. Tears were streaming down my face. I just walked out of detox, I have no idea what I'm doing, but he recognized that I was a newcomer. And, he asked me my name, and he told me his, and he introduced me to a number of people, and I just said, I can't remember any of this. And so I'm not good at names. I'm never going to remember names. So he started to jump up and down and yell, going, I'm Tony. I said, all right, your name I'll remember. He became a really, really, really good friend of mine. We went through a lot together. His wife was my sponsor. And unfortunately, she just passed away too, a few months ago. But that was the first time that was 12 step in action for me. He was at the door, he was there, he welcomed me, and he made me feel welcomed. It was a place that I found a great deal of fellowship. And people loved me, and I needed that. I truly needed that. But after a few years, I needed something more. The friends I made, the life I was beginning to have was great, but I needed a little bit more. And I think what I need, it's not what I think. What I needed, I found. I think when I pray for the teacher to arrive, or when I pray for the teacher, it will come to me. When I stay open. And I met some people who were doing work in the Big Book. I didn't know about steps. I knew about reading, you don't have enough here, steps off of the wall. I knew what that was. I thought when I read them, I was doing them. I had a lot of grace in my life. I didn't really feel like I had recovery in my life at that point. I was still, the voices were still talking in my head, real big time. And in a lot of ways, they were still ruling my life. I still have the voices in my head. They still talk, but I can tell them to be quiet today. There's a difference. They don't really go away, by the way. They just get more manageable. And they listen to me now. That's the difference. We figured out we've decided who's the boss most of the time. When I give up the power to the voices in my head, then that's where I go off. But I needed to find a program of recovery. I found the fellowship, which is one side of the triangle. And that was really, really important to me. And I needed that. But I needed now the bottom part of the triangle, which is the recovery. And that I found in the steps. And I found people who showed me what the steps were about. And they showed me where I'm powerless or how I'm powerless. I didn't always think I'm powerless. I didn't recognize where I always thought, well, gee, yeah, I can do this, but I'm not. I don't have it. The things that I was able to do up to that point, I was able to do because the grace of God helped me. But I wasn't, I didn't see the powerlessness. I still thought I could have control. That word for me, control, I don't want it anymore. I still think I have it at times, but I don't want it anymore. There's a freedom in no control. And I like that. I really do. So they showed me what powerlessness was about. And at that point, when I finally recognized and accepted my powerlessness, it's not a fun place to be. Even if you're 3 years sober. It's suddenly like, pardon my French, but oh shit, now what do I do? It's sort of like you took away the wharf, the pier, you took away the oars, and now I'm just floating around in this river, where am I going? I'm just floating. I don't know where I'm going. I needed to find a power greater than myself, which is what my second step was. I always thought I had that, and what I had was the God of my childhood, and I had the God of my religion, but it wasn't a God that was personal to me. that was part of my life that I depended on a regular basis. It was a God I went to when I went to church on Sunday, or the God I went to when I was in another mess and, oh, please get me out of this. I had to find a God for me that was personal, that lived here, not up there. I had to find a God that lived here. And I did. You know, it took some work, and I had a relationship with a God. I had to form a relationship, you know, but it was a very distant one. You're up there, I'm down here. I had to make one that was personal. I had to make friends with this God of mine. I mean, we had to be buddies. We had to be pals. You had to live in my hip pocket, or preferably in my heart, but I needed this God to be near me all the time. I did develop that. And once I developed that, I was able to turn, I was willing now to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God. And that seems like a huge thing. It's like turn it over, bring it back. No, it's just my will and my life are nothing more than my thoughts and my actions. And I can do on a regular basis, daily, bit by bit. I can turn my thoughts and my actions over to the care of this God. It's funny, it was something we were talking about a couple days ago, and I'm not sure how this works out, but it's sort of like what we were talking about, it's sort of like my thoughts are my humanity. They're going to be there. I'm going to think the thoughts. I've got the crazy voices in my head. That's part of my humanity. But what my actions are, what do I do with those? That's my divinity. That's the God that lives inside of me that I've turned my life over to. And so now I've got my third step. I'm pretty well settled with this. I finally get to a fourth step. It wasn't a very good fourth step, but it was the best I could do at that point. I've done many since then, and every one I've done has been a little bit deeper, a little bit more. I get a little bit more insight, but there is no such thing as a perfect fourth step. I do the best I can. I ask God to show me what He needs me to see, and that's it, you know, and I write it. I share it with another person, and I do my fifth step. I share it. In this case, the first time I shared it with the sponsor, the woman that turned me onto this work. I've since, as I said, I've done more fourth steps, and I've shared it with a number of different people. I've shared it with a group of women. I've shared it with multiple women at different times. I've shared one with a man, with my husband's permission. It was just interesting, different points of view, different ways of seeing things. All of it has been helpful. I need another person. All of you become my mirror. Because by myself, I said, I can't see me. I need to see me through your eyes. Because I can't see my own eyes. So I need you as my mirror. So that's why the fifth step is so incredibly important to me. Six and seven is becoming aware. Six and seven is like the turning point. It's so small. The big book has two paragraphs on six and seven. It's very small, but it's probably the most pivotal set of steps. Because this is the place where now I see all my character defects. I'm asking God, take me as you find me, defects and all, and help me work through these. It's not take my defects away. I wouldn't be human. If you could take all my defects away, I'd be divine. Lots of things I'm going to be while I'm walking on this earth, but divine is not one of them. I'm always going to be human. I'm always going to have defects. So I give these to God. I ask God to take them, the good and the bad in me, and to use me as He will. So it's, you know, it's like none of my business anymore. My life has nothing to do with me. I'm just the one that's experiencing it, but I don't direct it. So the control is gone, hopefully. Eight and nine, I made a list of the people I had harmed and made amends to them. Lots of ways to make amends. Obviously, financial amends are easy to see how to make. Pay the money back. that's very simple. You stole money, pay it back. You borrowed something, give it back, you know. Where I robbed people of their security, where I robbed people of their peace of mind, is other, you know, other kinds of amends I need to make. My dad's gone. He didn't see a whole lot of my alcoholism, particularly, because I wasn't active when I lived at home, and he died when I was in college, so or after college, but he never really saw a lot of it. My mom, neither one of my parents saw a lot of it, but my mom knew a whole lot more about it. There are times when I didn't call her for months on end. She knew where I was, but it was just that distance that I would put between us. Because I didn't want her to hear my alcoholism. I didn't want her to hear that. So I put that distance between us. So, you know, she had whatever thoughts she had about why I was that way. But I just, you know, I kept her at arm's length. I had a brother. I had a niece. I had cousins coming out the wazoo. And I, you know, I affected all of them in some way or other, sometimes by my presence and sometimes by the lack of my presence. You know, I hurt people I worked with. I had to look at that. And, again, I needed to look at that with another person, with a sponsor that was going to help me see where I needed to, where I needed, because there were times when I wanted to make amends for things that I didn't do. And then there were places where I didn't want to make amends for things that I did. And I needed to have somebody to show me that. You know, just exactly where I was trying to kind of, you know, make do. And oh, that's not too important. And it was, you know. Invariably the ones that are most, I think are least important, probably are the most important. And vice versa. So working, doing my amends, making amends as best I can. And there's always a way to make amends. I've done amends at graveside. I've done amends when I wasn't planning on making an amends. There's been a lot of experiences without going into a whole bunch of them. But there's always a way to make an amends. I don't believe that there's, you know, that you can sit on an amends and say that I couldn't make it, they're dead. There are lots and lots and lots of different ways of cleaning up your side of the street. In step 10, step 10 is being in the moment, being right here, right now, and being aware of what I'm doing at all times as much as I can. When I'm in the present, when I'm in right now, I don't worry about what happened before, and I can see, you know, as I said, my humanity tells me I'm going to make mistakes, I'm going to err at times. And so I can be, I don't have to wait to do another fourth step and fifth step and a formal 8 and 9. I can, you know, screw up at work and turn around and say, make the amends right there. Sometimes it's just an I'm sorry, and sometimes it's fixing what I did. But I can do that on a regular basis. Being aware, being awake to who I am and where I fit into this universe. Step 11 for me is just more, you know, increasing and enriching and enlarging the relationship I have with my higher power that I started in step 3. Actually, started in step 2. Any kind of friendship I have with another human being, whether it's with my husband or a friend, if I just say, hi, how are you, nice to meet you, you know, yes, I do, we're married, okay, fine, now I'm going to go about and live my own life, and don't foster that relationship, I don't take care of that relationship, I don't give time to that relationship, it's going to fade away. So that's what step 11 is for me. I want to keep the relationship I have with power, my higher power, alive, well, and real, real, real fresh. Because that's what saves my ass every day, that relationship with my higher power. So that's what, you know, so, and there are things in the book that tells me what I can do at night, what I can do in the morning, what I can do during the day. There's lots of instructions in this book. And then lastly, step 12. People talk about going through the steps as the work. I'm going to do the work, which in, you know, translates into I'm going to do the steps. A friend of mine says that's not the work. Going through the steps is not the work. It's the preparation for doing the work. The work is step 12. Get your butts out there and pass this message along to other people. That's the work. The steps is the preparation for the work. It gets me clear. And if you've never, you know, get yourself clear, do the work, and then get out there and work with somebody else. And I promise you one thing, absolutely 100% promise you, that whatever you feel when you go through the steps, and the relief and the freedom that you feel when you go through the steps, is one minuscule piece of what you feel when you can watch somebody else grow. And you can take them through the steps and show them the work and watch them blossom and grow and become a human being in the light of God. You know, and so, you know, do the steps, get to do the preparation, and get out there and work with other people. It's incredibly rewarding. It's fun. We have a lot of fun. And, you know, it just, I don't know what else to say. It's a life that I don't want to ever lose. And to do that, I continue doing the work that I've, you know, the stuff that I've just talked about on a regular basis as much as I can, which is one of the reasons why I'm here. And the last, just real briefly, the last angle of the last side of the triangle is service. Doing some service for people. Not just the 12-step work, but whatever else, you know, whether it's coffee, whatever your bent is, whether it's, you know, you're a good coffee maker, you're a good chairperson, you're a good secretary, you're a good treasurer, you're a good GSR, you know, be the GSR, work in the service structure if that's your, you know, if that's where you're going for, or intergroup. We need the larger picture as well, and that's what service is about. It's about keeping the larger picture. So all three sides of the triangles are vitally important. And I love the image of a three-sided stool. If I don't have all three legs on the three-sided stool, I'm swaying in the wind. But if I have all three legs down on the ground, I've got a solid seat to sit on. So they just, I needed to throw in that little piece of service work too. So thank you very much for letting me say that.
Hi everyone, my name is Mike. I am an alcoholic.
Hey Mike.
I have a disease called alcoholism. I also have a home group, and it's called the Carry This Message Group in West Orange, New Jersey. And I'm very grateful to have a sobriety date of September 27th, 1993. And for that, the Monmouth County Police Department is very truly grateful. It's good to be here. I want to thank Allison for inviting us. And it's always a pleasure to share the podium with my lovely wife, Kathy. And I don't know if she knows this or not. She should know this, but in my eyes, you will always be divine. You know, sometimes I'm a runner, and I've been training for a half marathon, and if God wills it, I'll be doing my very first full marathon next April. And that's just really impossible for a guy like me, especially at 240 pounds, to be even thinking about running 26 miles. And I don't know why it usually happens when I'm going for a run, but lately I've just been really overcome by emotions. And maybe it's because, by the way, if I don't do anything really stupid within the next 2 weeks, I'll be celebrating my 10th anniversary. And that's a testament to you guys. But lately I've been, every once in a while I'll get really overcome with these emotions. It'll just come to me in a flash, and I'm running, and I'm listening, and I got Eminem playing in the headphones, or Led Zeppelin, and I'm breaking down in tears, and this isn't supposed to be happening. And it's just like, man, what in the world is a guy like me doing, living a beautiful, wonderful, sober, for the most part, sane life like this, coming from where I came from? It just doesn't work that way. And that's a testament to you people, the fellowship. That's a testament to the 12 Steps, which is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a testament to God as I understand God. That basket's making me dizzy. I heard something really cool. I'm a plagiarist. Half of my pitch, 95% of my pitch, if you call up any of the local AA tapers, you can probably hear it on their tapes from other speakers. But I heard a real cool story this week. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we love to talk about relationships, right? And so if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what you're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for is a relationship, your odds are pretty good. If what you're coming to AA for is to find a relationship, your odds are good. The only drawback to that is the goods are pretty odd. That is no reflection on my wife, Kathy.
Very good. We'll talk about that later.
I drank. That's probably how I got this way. I drank. I liked alcohol. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I had no conception of God until I found a bottle of alcohol. It was a power greater than myself. Did for me what I could not do for myself. As a matter of fact, can I borrow that book that we usually don't like to talk about? I have no idea how old I was when I took my very first drink. But I'm pretty sure that one of my first drinks, at least that I can remember, came in the form of a gallon jug of white wine. And let me tell you something. If I was 12 or 13 or 14 or 8 years old or however old I was, I needed to drink alcohol. Because I think, now remember, I was a blackout drinker, so my recollection is not that clear. The beautiful woman in the front row here, we were kind of joking before, and we were talking about memory lapses, and I said, oh, you suffer from CRS also. And she looked at me and she said, what's CRS? I said, CRS, you know, can't remember stuff. And it seems like right out of the chute, I was restless, irritable, and discontented, and I was full of fear, guilt, shame, and remorse, and all that happened was the doctor smacked me on the behind. You know, and I don't know where I developed these feelings that we love to talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know where I developed this image of myself. I mean, on one hand, I'm an egomaniac, and you know, don't you know who I am? You people aren't paying enough attention to me. But then when you do, I'm not worth it. Because I'm a piece of crap. And I'm not worthy of your attention. But don't you know who I am when you're not giving it to me? But then you give me too much and I get all confused and, man, I need a drink. And whenever it was I took that very first drink, I needed it real bad and didn't know it. And I found that gallon jug of white wine in my father's liquor cabinet, and I think all I did was take a few swigs off that sucker, and it was big. It was a gallon, and I lifted that big old sucker up to my lips, and I took a couple chugs, and I swigged it down, and everything was all right. Everything was all right. What that alcohol did for me was, I felt a new freedom and a new happiness. I no longer regretted the past, nor did I wish to shut the door on it. After a few drinks of alcohol, I comprehended the word serenity. And I knew peace. After a couple of swigs on that gallon of white wine, I didn't care how far down the scale I went. I could see how my experiences could benefit others. Right? I'm drinking, you should too. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity disappeared. And I began to lose interest in selfish things. And I gained a whole lot of interest in my fellows, especially if they were drinking alcohol. Self-seeking slipped away and my whole attitude and outlook on life changed when I drank alcohol. And so did fear of people and economic insecurity. That began to leave me. And when I started to drink alcohol, I intuitively knew how to handle situations which used to baffle me. And the way I usually did that was to... There you go. There's an alcoholic in the room. She's right back there. Took another drink. Took another drink. I used to say all the time, I don't think I've said it lately, but alcohol was the cure for what ailed me. Alcohol was my medication for life, which was my problem. Alcohol was the solution for a little while. See, I can't relate. I can't identify to people who come up to a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, God, I hate alcohol. I hate the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I love alcohol. To this day, I love alcohol because if it wasn't for me drinking alcohol, I wouldn't be alive. I couldn't take it in that world sober. I couldn't handle it. See, alcohol gave me all those beautiful promises before I knew there was another way to get all those beautiful promises. I didn't know it. For those AA historians in the room, one of the, Bill Wilson called him a founder, one of the early founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, Harry Thiebault, who carried the message to Roland, who carried the message to Ebby, who carried the message to Bill, who carried the message to Bob, who carried the message to Bill D, AA number 3, on and on and on, who eventually ended up carrying the message to me. But what Dr. Harry Thiebault said was that in Latin terms, you can call what the alcoholic suffers from in Latin spiritus contra spiritum. And in my limited Latin translation, which I've never spoken a lick of Latin in my life, I stole this too, what that means is God over alcohol. That's what I needed. Didn't know it. And at that time, alcohol was the only God in my life. It was a power greater than myself. It did for me what I could not do for myself. For about 5 minutes. Because each and every time I drank after that, I was always chasing the initial effect I got. And to some degree or another, it got less and less and less and less. But I can tell you from the illness standpoint, as our book outlines it, I know I have a physical allergy. Because every time I took a drink of alcohol, the same thing happened to me time and time again. Every time I took the first drink, the same thing happened to me. And if you're a real alcoholic sitting in this room, I guarantee you the same thing happened to you. Anybody want to take a guess what happened to me after I took the first drink? No, I didn't get drunk. I took the second drink. I took the second drink. And then the second drink took the third, and the third took the fourth, and the fourth took the man. We like to say in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that it's the first drink that gets you drunk, but I didn't get that when I came here. You guys had to explain that to me. Because when you told me, Mike, the first drink gets you drunk, I want to know what you're drinking, because you got some good stuff. I didn't know about the physical allergy. I didn't know about the craving that my body has to alcohol. Somehow, some way, I'm different than the average normal temper drinkers, and don't let me get up here and talk about those social drinkers, because they make me want to puke. They do sick stuff, like have one or two and then tell the bartender, no, no more, no thanks, no more for me, I'm beginning to feel it. And Kathy and I are sitting over at a dinner table, and I'm like wanting to throw my plate at the guy. That's the point. You're supposed to feel it. That's why I drank alcohol. I drank alcohol for the effect produced by the alcohol. Alcohol did something for me and to me, which nothing else in my life ever did. I also have this thing called a mental obsession, which throughout my drinking, when I would try to stop drinking, which wasn't very often, my mind would bring me back to a drink. I'm not going to drink today. I have a college exam. I'm not going to drink. I have an important meeting to attend. I'm not going to drink because of this, because of that, because of this. And I was able to pull that off for a little while. And then somewhere along the line, my mind said, we'll just take one or two to have the edge off. But I forgot about the fact that the night before, I closed up the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning. I am not physically capable of having one or two just to take the edge off. But my mind tells me I am. And it just leads to a senseless series of spring and remorse. Round and round she goes. Where it stops, the judge usually knows. And then when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys told me that there's a third component of my disease, and I didn't get it for a long time. I would like to say I didn't hear it for a long time, but I think you guys were telling me, I just didn't hear it. That thing is called the spiritual malady. See, what Alcoholics Anonymous offers me is a three-part solution for a three-part illness. I have an illness of the body, the mind, and the spirit, and you guys offer me a program that treats the body, bring my body to the fellowship, unity, the side of the triangle that Kathy talked about, the left side, right? Unity, fellowship. I bring my body here. Chances are when I come to the meetings, I'm not going to pick up a drink. Where do I take my mind? I take my mind to the program recovery, the base of the triangle. Like Kathy said, the program recovery is the 12 steps. As outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. 12 and 12 has some nice essays on the steps, by the way, to broaden and deepen the experience you had with the big book. Good book, read it. And then there's that third piece, the service piece, that Kathy so eloquently talked about. This beautiful thing called love and service. That Dr. Bob, his last talk, right before he died, he was on his deathbed practically. He talked at the International Convention, and he said the most people will be quoting this 200 years from now. And he said, what Alcoholics Anonymous boils down to is love and service. And by the grace of God, you people, good sponsorship, a home group that keeps me in check, and a God that loves me when sometimes I don't know how to love myself. My life today is about love and service. And the service piece of that triangle is what treats the spiritual disease. Dis-ease. The book calls it a spiritual disease. I like to break it down. Dis-ease. I was always at dis-ease. And when I go back through the steps today, I can see how it's not the first drink that's going to get me drunk. It happens long before that. It happens with this thing that the book refers to as the spiritual malady, because on 64 it says when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically and not before. But if the spiritual malady is not overcome, I'm going to be in big trouble mentally and physically. I know this out of my own experience. Because the root of my problem is not that I put a bottle of whiskey in my hand and put it to my lips. The root of my problem, and it may not be yours, but the root of my problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. It's all about me, or it should be all about me. Selfishness and self-centeredness. And from that stems all forms of fear, all forms of character defects, dishonesty, resentments. The list goes on and on. And if I live in that, see, that's the unmanageability that we talk about in step one. People like to say, well, I'm convinced I have an unmanageable life, but nobody knows what that looks like. My unmanageable life is my self-centeredness. My unwillingness to do something for you. My willingness to get out of myself and help this the next still sick and suffering alcoholic. And if I stay in that selfishness and self-centeredness and dishonesty and resentment and inconsideration long enough, I'm going to block God out. And eventually, my mind is going to say, well, you're feeling pretty restless, irritable, and discontented, aren't you? Why don't you just take one or two to take the edge off? And I'll believe the lie that my mind's telling me. And I'll just take one or two to take the edge off. And because I have the physical aspect of our disease, I can't stop at one or two. So like I said, I got sober in September of 93. I landed in the rehab that worked for me. It was a dry out joint that worked for me. It was called the Monmouth County Police Department. They'll sober you up real quick. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was guided to Alcoholics Anonymous 3 days later. And I don't know why I remember this. Most people don't remember their first meeting, and I have absolutely no recollection of what was said in my first meeting, but I remember one thing. And my friend Jameson says it so beautifully, and I'm going to steal it from him. My first step was the 12th step in another man's heart. It irritates me slightly today when people have been in this fellowship for a period of time and have not that they don't want one, but they have difficulties finding a sponsor. I can't find a sponsor. Can't find anyone that has what I want. You've been sober 2 weeks. How do you know what you want? But see, I didn't have to go looking for a sponsor when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I understand that's pretty rare nowadays. A sponsor came looking for me in the form of a gentleman named Henry L. And to this day, I will always be grateful to that man. He was 2 years sober. He really wouldn't have known a step if it would have bit him on the face. But he put his hand out to me. I made the mistake of nudging him with my elbow because I heard this term sponsor being used, and I said, could you tell me after the meeting what's this sponsor? He misinterpreted what I said because he's a good alcoholic. He thought I was asking him to be mine. And for that I'm truly grateful because he put his hand into mine and said, Mike, I will help you. I will be your sponsor. He taught me how to get busy. He taught me how to get busy in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Taught me how to make coffee. He taught me. He said, you will join this home group. I didn't know any different. I did what was asked of me. Because I had reached the state of what we call surrender. And I hear that thrown around like a 25-cent word, too. Oh, I'm hurting real bad. I'm in big trouble. And then you'll get an old-timer in the back of the room that has his arms folded. And he says, well, kid, all you got to do is surrender. Like that's something I have the power to do. Well, today is September 13th. I think I'll surrender. Don't have the power to surrender. Never did. Surrender is something that happens to me and for me, and it's usually by the grace of God. It's a pure, unearned gift. Usually happens as a result of a lot of pain. And by the grace of God. That man put his hand in mine, and life's never been the same since. He gave me what he had on the steps back in those early days of my sobriety. He literally stayed one step ahead of me. And I'm here to tell you that if you got 2 days sober, you can help a person with 1 day. If you're on page 2 of the book, you can help someone who's on page 1 of the book. Don't let anybody tell you, well, you're not on step 12, you can't help somebody. If you feel it in your heart. Listen, 30 seconds and I'll let you go. I want to go to all the meetings in northern New Jersey. Go to all the meetings I can possibly find with the slogans hanging up on the wall, and I want to rip them up. Take them down off all the walls, all the slogans. Got nothing against the slogans, love the slogans, but they're just too complicated for a guy like me. Easy does it, live and let live, first things first, but for the grace of God, all great things. All very helpful once I've been through the 12 steps. But didn't mean much to me when I was new. I want to replace those slogans with one slogan, and I'll probably owe Nike royalties on this. But my favorite slogan that's always worked for me is just do it. And in our home group, after we say the prayer, we don't close with keep coming back. We close with stay. So what I would like to tell you, if you're new in this room, don't just keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Stay here. Thank you.